From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent of Lebanese descent and author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. And we're coming to you from his office in New York City on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Ali Soufan is currently the chief executive officer of the Soufan Group, that's a strategic intelligence consultancy. 15 years after the September 11th terror attacks on U.S. soil, international crises have only increased. A seemingly intractable war in Syria, which has taken more than 500,000 lives and displaced millions, a refugee crisis, the likes of which we have not seen since World War II, the growth of the so-called Islamic State or Daesh in Iraq and Syria, proxy battles between the Gulf Arab states and Iran in Syria and Yemen, and a resurgent Russia, just to name a few. We'll talk with Ali Soufan about how to best understand, as well as to effectively address these challenges in the middle of a U.S. presidential election campaign. Ali Soufan, welcome back to the program.
Always great to be with you.
It certainly is. This is becoming an annual tradition now.
We have to keep it.
Absolutely. Well, the last time, in fact, we were here, Ali, we were talking about Russia's entry into Syria. They had just come in to basically prop up Bashar al-Assad, who was on the ropes. They went in, airstrikes, Russian military people, and now, a year later, they seem to really be in the driver's seat. President Obama had predicted that there would be a quagmire for Russia, but so far that hasn't panned out. In fact, many would say that Vladimir Putin has actually turned the tide of the war in favor of Bashar al-Assad. We witnessed in recent days an attack on a humanitarian convoy, allegedly by Russian airstrikes. Things really couldn't get much worse.
Russia has its own national interest in Syria, and this national interest is based on many factors. First, you have more than 7,000 foreign fighters who came from former Soviet republics, to include about 2,400 from Russia itself, are fighting in Syria, and I think the Russians believe that this is a big threat to them. But also, at the same time, Russia supports the Syrian regime, not necessarily Assad, but the regime itself. And that regime is a proxy regime for the Russians in the region. Third, Russia has geopolitical interests over there. They have a naval base. They have access to the Mediterranean waters. And that's something also we have to keep in mind. And Russia felt that the war in Syria and the lack of coordination from the other side will give them a space to operate and to increase their expansion into world politics. If you look at the opposition to Assad, which started as a legitimate opposition against a dictator. But today, if you look at the opposition, we have so many different groups on the ground. You have ISIS, but also you have moderate rebels, two. And then three, and most importantly, because of the confusion that it's creating, even in the relationship with the Russians, is Al-Qaeda, either in its the name al-Nusra or the name Fath al-Sham, that branding that they did. Many of the rebel groups, excluding ISIS, definitely Daesh, don't see a problem in working very closely with Fath al-Sham and Fath al-Nusra. And that's creating a problem for actually the coalition that we have, the international coalition. We have a coalition of 65 nations, but let's be frank, most of the countries are not doing anything. So the only thing that we're actually giving is a foundation for ISIS, for their campaign. They're saying, look, we have 65 countries attacking us. God is on our side. After all these years, we're still here. This is the end of time. This is Dabak. See, 65 nations came to attack us. But in reality, most of these nations have competing interests, and most of these nations don't see eye to eye. One of our greatest ally in the region is a NATO ally, Turkey. Turkey is less interested in ISIS as much as in preventing a Kurdish state on their southern borders. You have the Gulf states, all allies, but each one of these states have a competing interest, even in the future of Syria. You have, you know, the Europeans, and their involvement have been in so many ways limited. Some of them only attack ISIS in Syria, but they don't do it in Iraq. Some of them attack in Iraq, but they don't do it in Syria. It's airstrikes, very few direct involvement on the ground. So yes, we have 65 nations, but we have a lot of competing interest, even on the international and regional level. And that competing interest on the international level and the regional level creating a sense of confusion and chaos on the local level. So we have aspiration for solving the Syrian conflict. Unfortunately, this aspiration is very limited with the regional and local realities on the ground.
But other critics would say, Ali, that it's also limited because the United States in particular wants to solve this through diplomacy, but diplomacy alone is not possible unless you have leverage at the negotiating table, which means you need to have battleground advantage for the U.S.-backed mainstream rebels, which they do not have. And Russia came in to fill a vacuum to prop up Bashar al-Assad. So there have been points throughout this conflict from 2011 in which groups, the United States, the so-called Friends of Syria, perhaps could have intervened more aggressively, not boots on the ground. The rebels were not calling for that, but done more. They didn't really step up to the plate.
Well, we're talking about today, and we're talking about what's going on today. There's two things. There are things about ending ISIS, and there is another thing is about the Syria civil war and how do you end the Syria civil war. I think we have an agreement now that a military solution is impossible in Syria, and it has been impossible for a while. And only when other entities, to include many of the rebels, start realizing that it's not a zero-sum game, and the regime also start to realize it's not a zero-sum game, then we can start putting the potential solution plan for Syria on the right path.
Okay, we can go back. Like you said, we can't undo what was done or not done. The inaction that critics say occurred on the part of the United States, either by not enforcing the red line, very targeted strikes on Bashar al-Assad's military, to at least send a signal, say that we mean what we say we enforce. Therefore, the failure of using the kind of leverage that the United States or other countries have, this is part of the problem. So certain, you know, targeted strikes, even now, because right now there is no punishment for even, you know, attacking a humanitarian convoy. Everything Bashar al-Assad and the Russians are doing seems to be with impunity.
Well, look, as you mentioned, we can go back and debate things. And, you know, we talked about this last year and what we could have done early on and what was possible and what's not possible. But also at the same time, we have to deal with the reality today. And we have to understand that there are so many countries that's involved in this quagmire of Syria. Right? You have Iran, you have Russia, you have all the Gulf states, you have Turkey, you have a lot of ethnic issues, Kurds, Turkmen, Arabs, Shia, Sunni. So we have to keep that in mind when we're thinking about what can we do and what we cannot do. You don't want to jump into a quagmire and make it worse for yourself and for others. There are a lot of people who have weapons. There are a lot of people who are fighting. The problem is, how can we make them understand that the fighting is not going to be the solution? Maybe we made a lot of mistakes before, but today we have to talk about the future. There's a huge humanitarian problem in Syria. It started to affect the national security of countries in the region, not even mentioning Europe and the refugee situation. You have a problem in Turkey. You have a problem in Jordan. You have a problem in Lebanon, where almost one-fifth of the population are refugees. You have more than 400,000 people who were murdered because of the Syrian war. You have a generation growing up with no education, with only images of violence and hate. How can you put Syria together? How can you build bridges among communities that have no trust with each other? These are the issues that we have to think about. What did we do before? What didn't we do before? I might probably sit down and criticize for hours and hours about things that went wrong. But also at the same time, let's keep everything in context and think about how we can make the situation better.
What would you advise at this point, Ali Soufan, given the situation right now where you have a resurgent Russia, Iran backing Bashar al-Assad to the hilt, and many say that he is as much a threat, if not more so, to the people. And he's a state sponsor, in fact, of terrorism in a sense.
He is
a state sponsor of terrorism, actually.
He is a state sponsor.
And he is terrorizing, you know, his own people through barrel bombs filled with chlorine gas and basically getting away with murder without any kind of penalty. It's a sad situation. And this is not to in any way defend the Islamist extremists on the other side.
Right.
Something happened in the meantime that weakened the civilian legitimate opposition and the Free Syria Army defectors?
First of all, we have to review our Syria policy. Second, as part of the review, we have to guarantee that all our allies are operating from the same sheet of music, not everybody doing their own thing. Third, we have to identify who is the enemy and who's not the enemy. And we have to force all the people that we support on the ground to make a very distinct separation between them and between al-Qaeda or any of its affiliates. And then we have to deal with all the foreign fighters, and that can be done with the coordination, even with Turkey, with Russia. And in order to do so, all these things can be accomplished. But we need the power of diplomacy. We need the power of American leadership. And when we have the power of diplomacy, we have the power of American leadership, we carry the carrot and we carry a bigger stick to enforce the carrot, then I think we can start getting into a solution. Unfortunately now, we see the enemy, they are unified. Russia have Iran under its control and the Assad regime under its control. Our area, our side, everybody is operating on a different music sheet, unfortunately. And we can see that reflecting very directly on the ground. And the United States need to take the leadership in leading diplomatically from the front, not from behind. The Russians taken advantage of the chaos on our side in the coalition. So let's take advantage from our side first. Let's make our side agree on what kind of outcome we want and how are we going to accomplish it. And then we can deal with the Russians and the Iranians. We wanted a coalition to get rid of ISIS. Most of the Syrian people want a coalition to get rid of Assad. This is where our problem is. The Russians don't have a problem. The Russians are saying, we want a coalition to protect the regime and destroy everyone else who is fighting the regime. Very simple message. Very coherent message. Very direct message. With us, let's have a coalition. All of you guys rebelled against a tyrant. You wanted to change the regime. You want freedom. We support you, but let's get rid of ISIS. It's not as coherent and it's not as straightforward message. And when you have a problem between your strategy, your tactics, and your messaging, you're going to have some sort of complication, even with your allies. People look into the Syria conflict through two different visions. One vision is a counterterrorism vision. How can we contain that vacuum and keep the threat inside that region and prevent it from spreading around and creating terror in our cities and around the world? So it's a counterterrorism strategy to deal with a situation on the ground in order to contain the threat. The other lens are people who think of Syria as nothing but another front in the war against Russia. So you have two different views, and each one can be accomplished. But if you accomplish it, it's a totally different tactics to reach that strategy. So now our strategy appears to be very much counterterrorism strategy.
And one more question with regard to the Assad regime, a state sponsor of terrorism. Do you see the Assad regime, a state sponsor of terrorism, is just as much a threat as non-state actors like ISIS? Since the regime's practice of terror, the way it treats its citizens, civilians, anybody who isn't for Assad is against Assad and therefore a terrorist in his view, as basically a recruiting bonanza for ISIS, for the Nusra Front, now called Fatah al-Sham. So it's almost like a vicious circle.
You know, you can make that argument, and there are facts to support the argument. However, Al-Qaeda and ISIS existed way before the war in Syria, and they are taking advantage of the situation in Syria for their own thing. The viciousness of ISIS, the beheading, the burning of people, the terrorist attacks that they are sponsoring and advocating and calling for around the world, I think ISIS is a totally different animal. So is Al-Qaeda. ISIS is probably think in the short term, but Al-Qaeda is thinking the long term. And we can see that now in places like Syria. We can see it in places like Yemen. We can see it in places like North Africa, for example, in Libya. Al-Qaeda definitely expanding, and I think they pose a strategic danger.
We'll be back in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan. He's author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11, and The War Against Al-Qaeda. He's also CEO of the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based in New York City. And we are coming to you from his office in New York. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, and connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener from Jigawa State, Nigeria, Ishak Ringham. We also want to hear from you. What insights have you gleaned from our conversation with Ali Soufan? Write to us at PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us your name, where you're from, and how you listen to the program. Well, back to our special guest, Ali Soufan. Ali, before we turn away from Syria, just one sort of large overarching question, and that is, at the end of the day, how do you think many in the mainstream opposition, predominantly Sunni but not exclusively, civilians and the Free Syria Army and others, how do you think they will judge the United States after feeling essentially abandoned? They called for no troops. They called for extra help. They wanted to be able to weigh back, you know, defeat. And now things have gotten so out of control. And again, I'm not blaming any one particular actor. You have the Russians now, the Iranians, the Iran deal took place. How do you think they feel? Have we lost a generation, created more resentment?
All the stuff that you mentioned are true. And there are a significant level of resentment and sometimes hatred against the United States for not supporting them and for not aiding them and assisting them in getting rid of Assad. And that's something that, you know, we have to deal with. This is the reality on the ground. But I hope down the road, our interests and their interests are the same. And eventually that we're going to start seeing a move on a political path, a political solution, because frankly, I think that's the only way forward. And many of the regional players agreeing now on the importance of the political solution. Now we need to convince the Assad regime and we need to convince the Russians, but also we need to convince some of the opposition groups on the ground that the political solution is the only way forward. Unfortunately, from what we saw from the activities of the regime and the Russian bombing of the humanitarian convoy, what we see with what al-Nusra is doing, also everybody is thinking that they can cement their victories on the ground. And they need to realize that there is no military solution, and the Russians cannot win this, Assad cannot win this, and Al-Qaeda cannot have a sanctuary in northern Syria, and ISIS cannot continue to exist the way it's existing. And ISIS has been losing a lot of territory. In the last year since we last spoke, it lost about 40% of the areas that they controlled by this time last year. But the threat continues to exist. And I think ISIS and other terrorist groups are more dangerous, I believe, as they are dying, because now they are hitting everywhere. They are under a lot of pressure, and they were at one point a terrorist organization operating underground. Then they became an insurgency. Then they became a proto-state, and now they are going back underground to be a terrorist organization that's operating outside Baghdad, outside the Sunni Triangle in Iraq. They are also operating in Paris. They are also operating in Brussels, in Istanbul, and even inspiring people to attack here in the United States.
Right now, we're approaching the fight against ISIL from more of a military perspective because they've declared a caliphate, and they are losing territory as a result of the U.S.-led coalition. But many critics or analysts would argue that that is simply not enough. You can be displaced. But for example, let's look at Iraq. You have a regime that has for many years under Maliki, now under Abadi, perhaps differently, but to some extent marginalized the Sunni population.
Yep.
And this Sunni population, if you talk to some of them, they feel a greater threat from the Shia militias than they do from ISIS, even though they do not like ISIS. So they're really caught. So some would say you need a political formula. The Sunni population has to be, you know, more politically integrated. So what other ways do you think ISIL can be defeated in addition
to the military? You mentioned exactly what I'm talking about. Sectarianism is a problem that's providing oxygen to groups like ISIS. You have other issues. You have issues that has to do with dictatorships, as we were talking about Assad before. We have issues that have to do with corruption. We have issues that has to do with an education system where people are kind of like, you know, they look around and they decide, oh, it's so complicated, everything is wrong. The best option we have is to go backward or to destroy the whole thing and start again. So there are so many different factors that's feeding organizations like ISIS. So if you wanted to do a solution, the solution have to be first a regional solution where regional countries agree not to use sectarianism in war against each other. Iran is doing it with the Shia militia. Saudi is doing it in supporting Sunnis. Sometimes that support can go to extremist groups. You have the issues with the Arabs and, you know, Persians. There's so much computing factors on the ground that's feeding into that vacuum that exists and allow organizations like ISIS to function. So what we need to do is we first need to provide a regional solution for that. At the same time, you need to hit ISIS and similar groups very hard. ISIS, as long as they have a caliphate, ISIS, as long as they have cities that they control, they have sanctuary, they will continue to operate. So we need to basically have our strategy against them multidimensional. So we need to defeat them on the ground. We need to create coalitions on the ground to take away the towns and the cities that they control, like what happened recently in Jarablus, for example. And in the same time, we need to combat that space that they have in the hearts and minds of people around the world that they inspire. And the only way to defeat them is not by depriving them from the physical space, is by also depriving them from that psychological space. So our strategy against ISIS need to be multidimensional, and it need to be global in its approach and its our execution.
I want to turn now briefly, Ali Soufan, before we close, to the bombings in New York and New Jersey, very close to home here. And as a former FBI supervisory agent, I'd really like to get your assessment of this event. Ahmed Rahami, an Afghan-born immigrant who perpetrated these crimes, he was discovered. What factors are known in your view? To what extent you think he was self-radicalized or inspired by Al-Qaeda, ISIS? We see from writings that he might have been going in this direction. And, right. And what have we learned from this?
It appears from the complaint and some of the evidence that has been made public that he was inspired by the narrative of Osama bin Laden, if you want to call it. Remember, ISIS is part of that narrative. ISIS came out of Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden planted this poisonous tree, and ISIS is a branch of the tree. I think he referenced Al-Qaeda literature. He referenced Al-Awlaki, which is AQAP. But it seems to me that he believes in that narrative. And sometimes people say, is this Al-Qaeda? Is this ISIS? You know, a lot of these guys who commit these acts, they don't differentiate because they believe both entities basically gives the same ideology. And a lot of these guys, especially a person like him, I don't think they care much about the issue of is there a caliphate or it's not a caliphate? What phase in the management of savagery are we in? So I think this is too much in the weeds for people who self-radicalize and try to, you know, convince themselves and justify carrying an act of hate or an act of terror by reaching out to what's put online by groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Unfortunately, these groups, 15 years after 9/11, they still inspire a lot of people. They still give a sense of identity for people who lack that sense of identity. And they continue to to use the ideology as a weapon. And since 9/11, we have been very successful in combating Al-Qaeda, combating other terrorist groups, disrupting the plots. We even killed Osama bin Laden himself. However, unfortunately, all these tactical successes did not mount into a strategic victory. It actually created a strategic disaster. 400 members of Al-Qaeda on the eve of 9/11 makes now a movement of thousands and thousands that go from the western shores of Africa to Southeast Asia. Al-Qaeda in Syria alone is bigger than what bin Laden ever dreamed of. You have presence in Libya, you have presence in Yemen. Just since last year, because of the war in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, their numbers went from 1,000 to 4,000. So that gives you an idea about how Al-Qaeda is expanding, how it's playing the long-term strategic game, how they are creating alliances locally with people who probably don't like Al-Qaeda or don't like what they stand for, but the enemy of the enemy is my friend kind of a situation.
Right.
And we see that in Syria,
see that in Yemen.
And we see that in many different places. We see that also in Somalia.
It's a very unfortunate situation. We're in a U.S. presidential election campaign, and all this is also being politicized. We have one candidate, Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, who continues to talk about banning Muslims from coming to the United States or playing that Muslim card, which many don't think is very helpful.
Well, it's definitely not helpful.
Nor is it the crux of the problem.
Well, you know, in the United States, for example, we don't have the problems that they have in Europe. In Europe, they did what some are advocating for here in the United States. They discriminated against communities. They had them live in ghettos, as you see in Belgium or as you see in France. They heavily discriminated against them based on religion and based on ethnic origins, where a lot of people, especially from the new generation, the second and third generation, they just have no emotional connection to the country where they were born. You see, many of them were inspired by the message of ISIS. They packed their bags and went to Syria to join the utopia, to join the caliphate. ISIS's message was very clean and crisp, and it's inspired them. We don't have that issue in the United States. In Belgium, for example, the Muslim community is about 500,000. You have more than 500 people who joined ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Huge number. In the United States, we're a nation of 315 million. We have 4 to 6 million Muslims. It depends on the definition. And we had 150 who went to Iraq and Syria. Statistically speaking, the Muslim community in the United States is considered the most diverse in the world. It is the richest Muslim community in the world. It is the most educated Muslim community in the world. It is actually the second most educated in the United States after the American Jewish community. So the American dream has been working. So to go and just try to create a policy based on what other people in Europe did long time ago, that will create a lot of hostilities, and you cannot discriminate and you cannot fight the community that you want their help the most in order to stop terrorism. So you know what? From a demagogue perspective, you can say stuff, but let's look into the reality of these things on the ground. And I think we are very lucky in the United States that we have a phenomenal law enforcement and intelligence agencies that's working very closely together to disrupt plots. We have been more successful than not. Nobody can be 100%, especially that the threat changed. If you look into the United States today, we don't have what they have in Europe. You don't have a command and control operation where groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda are directing the operations or ordering it from overseas. We have mostly people who self-radicalized over the internet. There are many other psychological, mental, sometimes political factors, like you see on Orlando, for example, or like you see with the Times Square bomber, you know, contribute to the radicalization. And then you see people shift significantly and sometimes in a very short period of time from the radicalization process to the mobilization process. And even with this threat that seems everywhere, we have been very fortunate that our law enforcement, our FBI, our JTTFs around the nation, Joint Terrorism Task Forces that we have around the nation, have been very successful in stopping a lot of the plots. Unfortunately, every now and then, you have a terrorist attack that happens, and any terrorist attack is one too many, but we have to look at the glass half full, not half empty, and try to understand the dynamics and the particulars of each case and each failure, and see what caused it, what were the gaps that we missed, and try to avoid them next time.
Ali Soufan is a former FBI supervisory special agent. He's currently CEO of the Soufan Group. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Dan Brody. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.